This is Nightlife with Suzanne Hill.
Now, if I was to take a bet where you live, it is most likely that you live in the city. So many Australians do. I mean, sometimes it's not a matter of choice. It depends on where the jobs are, maybe where your family is, where you can get good medical services. And as I said, for most Australians, that does mean living in a big city. But Australia is, in fact, one of the most urbanised countries in the world. And there's been some new data released this week, which talks all about urbanisation, not just in Australia, but having a look at what's going on around the world. Our resident demographer, Simon Kustamaha, has had his head in all of this, and he's here to talk about it and also to make a case in Australia for rebalancing, to be looking at ways to boost population growth in our regional towns. Hey, Simon, welcome back.
It's good to be back on.
Yeah. Now, I know you demographers get very excited about certain data sets that are your favourite. This stuff is all contained in a brand new one. It's called World Urbanisation Prospects. Tell us about it.
It's from the UN Population Division. So this is a bunch of demographers and data analysts who sit in New York and to analyze urban data from around the world. So we literally measure where the whole mankind, the whole human population lives. And we then divide this into cities, towns, and rural areas in those two or three rough categories. And we then just try to figure out how has this been changing over the last 70, 75 years in each country, in each locality, and how will this change over the next 25 years? And because they use a methodology that they can apply across the world, we can compare countries with each other, and we can, of course, see within a country, Australia in our case, how that changed over time. And that, of course, is quite interesting to see that we kind of shift certain kind of narratives that we have about who we are as Australians over time. Because if you go back to the 50s, it was the smallest share of us. Only just under 30% of us lived in a city. The majority, just under 40%, lived in towns, in regional towns. And still is somewhere in the middle between the remote areas where we lived. We still had more people in remote areas than living in the big cities in the 50s. And that, of course, completely shifted. By now, a small share of us live in what the UN would consider rural areas. The vast majority lives in cities. And then some sort of smaller share of the population lives in towns, according to, and again, you can look at ABS definitions, but a good rule of thumb is that just under 30% of us live in what we would consider regional Australia. It's 27% if you want the ABS classification.
Yeah. Now, Simon, how has all that changed over the past few decades?
Well, if you look at this, we doubled the share of the population that lives in the big cities over the last 70 years or so. So by now, if you just look at the last little while, we put such a high share in our big cities, in our big five cities, and an even higher share than the current population moves into those five cities. So at the moment, we are further centralizing our population in just the big cities. And the regional towns, the remote areas, they still grow in total population, but because they grow at a much slower rate than the big cities, we therefore see the regional, the rural population becoming less important, numerically speaking, meaning they make up a smaller share of the votership and therefore their voice can increasingly be ignored, assuming a cynical politician, not that these people would exist. This is a purely hypothetical scenario. But in that scenario, we would say it's quite easy to ignore a region because they make up a small share of the watership.
What about, Simon, all the tree changes that we heard so much about during COVID? How did that all shake out? Have some of those effects from people moving during COVID been reversed now? Or can you give us a sense of that?
Yeah, so one of the reasons, or pretty much the biggest reason why people moved to the regions was more affordable housing. Yes, there was some sort of health pandemic-related reason as well, but more than anything, it was you just get more bang for your buck if you move to a regional area. And turns out that those regional housing markets are relatively small. So in a small market, it only takes a relatively small increase of population to completely throw the housing market out of whack. So if you ask any caller in their regional town during the pandemic years, they would have seen rents first escalate like crazy and then house prices escalate like crazy. And because there wasn't that much more building activity that went online, these prices just kept escalating. And now those regional areas, they are not as cheap as they once were. And so people stopped flowing into those areas. The positive story, if you will, or the hopeful narrative is that it only would take relatively few new homes to pop up in those regional areas to create opportunities for growth due to much lower house prices in compared to bigger city house prices. But at the moment, this is not occurring. At the moment, we're still bleeding or we're just pushing house prices even higher in the regional towns. And then people say, well, that makes no sense. I get smaller wages on average if I have a regional job, but also my house is pretty much getting more and more expensive. So I'm not moving there. It's nice if you have a house that is accruing value of, if you live in a region, it's nice on paper, but until you sell it, it is of course a bit of a moot point there. But yeah, that's where we're at. So this COVID boom of regional cities kind of fizzled out because they were a victim of their own success.
Simon Kustamaha is here. Simon is the co-founder of the Demographics Group. Now, what about the, has the UN predicted what might happen to Australia as we continue down the path? Will we continue to become more and more urbanized?
Exactly. We have predictions, and if you align UN predictions or you look at ABS predictions, it is all the same stuff. Even higher share of us will move into the big cities, and a relatively smaller share of us will move to the rural and remote areas. In total terms, everything grows because we are a country that grows by 3.5 million people a decade. So that is an awful lot of growth. And so we'll fill up absolutely every remoteness category, as they're called. So that'll be fine. So there is growth per se. But we overestimate or we push too many people in the big cities. One of my favorite statistics there is that by the end of the Second World War, Australia was home to 7 million people. Since then, in the last 80 years, we quadrupled the population. So we went from 7 to 28 million Australians, and we put them all in the same cities. We only invented one new city in the last 80 years, and that's the Gold Coast. So in a sense, the Gold Coast is the single best thing Australia has done in the last 8 decades. And we should have created 7-8 new Gold Coasts, but we didn't. So we squeeze in more and more people into just the same cities. And then we wonder a bit why those cities keep sprawling and why those cities keep getting more expensive.
That's right. And why people are so cranky. You know, houses being ripped up in order to make way for apartments, traffic jams left, right and centre. So can we actually change this, Simon? Because, I mean, I've heard over the past 2 or 3 decades, you know, we're going to decentralize, we're going to move jobs to somewhere, we're going to encourage migrants who are coming in, we're going to say you are only allowed to come if you come and live in a certain area. I mean, I actually met somebody today who came from Zimbabwe 7 years ago as an electrician on a skilled migrant visa, and she told me she was living in Tamworth because that was the only option that she actually had when she applied for that visa. So if those things are happening, why isn't that balancing things up more?
Because we're doing this at an absolutely microscopic scale, the idea of regional visas. This is so small that it's not really important. Our migration system has a problem that we allow people essentially into the country based on their qualifications, and then we don't have any kind of mechanism in place to match this person with this particular qualification with an industry and employer that actually needs this this qualification and with the right region. So there's a geographical and there is an employer mismatch that is not happening. So if we, for example, say we want to introduce 1,000 new truck drivers into Australia, we essentially look for the first 1,000 people of the right age and so forth that have a trucking license. And then we let them into the country. We do not check that they work in the industry. We do not link them up with employers. We kind of just hope for the best. And that isn't the ideal way. So we could be much more targeted in our migration scheme. We're doing this with doctors. That's probably the best example, where as a doctor, much like your Zimbabwean electrician, you need to work first in a regional area for a couple of years. But the whole system knows that doctors do their stint in Horsham for 3 years, and then they move to the Gold Coast. So that's happening. That's fine. And you can keep this system going. If you constantly push in new overseas doctors into Horsham, they do their couple of years there, and then you lose them to a different region. It's exhausting, this kind of narrative. It's really difficult. But at the moment, that's where we're at. And I think a complete overhaul of a migration system could actually fix quite a few of those problems.
I mean, one of the interesting things is I know that, you know, many small towns cry out for doctors. They advertise extensively. We're going to give you a free house. You know, you're going to be the centre of the community. Everybody's going to love you. And still those towns struggle sometimes to attract people. Because you say if we're going to get people to the regions, there are actually, I think, five things that a town needs to offer. And livability is one of those.
Exactly. And livability is this big, vague term that includes things like, how often is my town being burned down, flooded? How climate resilient is it? Does it have nice nature? And so forth. These areas, the livability factor, that is pretty much set. Yeah, a town is located where it is located. It has the climate that it has. It has the natural beauty that it has. But there are four other factors that a regional town has much more control over. And so if the town, if the whole region, the business community, the local council, all those charitable organizations, if everyone works together, you can get you can attract population. And the first thing that you need to offer in the regions is, of course, jobs. But what we keep forgetting is that, let's say you want to attract an aged care worker. Let's say you want to attract a doctor. It is not enough to just offer that job, because most households in Australia are now dual income households because of the high cost of living. So that means for each job that you have open, you need to ensure not just to find a person that wants that job, but also has a partner who also finds a job in that region. So the job matching in particularly small housing markets or small towns is then particularly difficult. And of course, you want to offer jobs that have a certain kind of longevity, that are not just seasonal or project based. But so let's say you have enough jobs on offer, you then still need to provide a house or a home for those workers, because if you don't offer housing, people won't come to your place. And so not only does housing need to be available, it also needs to be affordable. That is, of course, linked on how much money you give these workers. That's what defines affordability. But you also want to have a different range of housing options. Quite often, a regional town only offers family-sized type accommodation. But what if you want to attract a single aged care worker who is mostly after remittances to pay back home to their Pacific island? Yeah, it's a very common scenario. And these workers, maybe you can room them in a house or something like this. But overall, a smaller housing option must be available to attract certain kind of jobs. So you see jobs and housing, but you also want basic services, you know. So a family wouldn't move nowhere if childcare, if schooling isn't available. The older you get, the more particular you become about the healthcare needs that you might have. And of course, you want to have basic services like supermarkets, pharmacies, whatever, these kind of things available. And if your town is large enough to have that on offer, that's pretty good. Then you're only worrying about the fourth factor here, that's connectivity. How well is your town linked via road, via rail? You get brownie points for a regional airport. Yeah. And we underestimate how important regional airports are. I'm always joking, give absolutely everything to a regional airport. They are absolutely crucial in attracting population. So if you have all of those five things on offer, your town will grow. But it is, of course, much easier said than done.
So what can local towns do, and what needs to be done by state and federal governments to manage the way that immigrants are settling in Australia? Whose job is it?
If I'm talking about something like connectivity, then any kind of small regional town would point to either federal or state money and say, we want this or that rail connection, that or that, this or that highway upgrade. And this is all well and good. But the hope there is, of course, not overly big that this actually happens, because infrastructure is being handed out based on political considerations, meaning I'm putting my infrastructure project there where I have the most voters, and that is most certainly not regional Australia. So I'm going to build my infrastructure, somewhere in the big city vicinity where I have more voters. So I'll do that. So that is difficult. Of course, a regional town would ask for a certain kind of visa policies to attract skilled labor from overseas. That's federal. They could argue for that. But I would argue towns, instead of just crying for state and federals, a really proactive town looks at what they can do themselves. And this would be about proactively hunting for job candidates. So to really guide a potential candidate, not just through this job search for this particular job in question, but also take a deep interest in their partner's needs and then network within the town and figure out how you might find a job for the partner. That's crucial. As a local area, you have certain kind of limited levers to make land available. That's to make sure that housing is available. And of course, I think a really switched on town, a really switched on local mayor would want to become some sort of pilot project. This is the idea where you go as a small town, you say, hey, we are sizable enough to be the lab rats, if you will, for some sort of housing project. What is a 50 house community of prefab houses, of 3D printed housing? What does that look like? Let's test run it here. Yeah. And so this is the type of stuff where, the bold towns, they have the biggest, opportunity to actually gain a bit of population.
But Simon, do you see any doing these things, or does it feel like we're just sort of sleepwalking blindly into the predictions that the UN is making about our increased urbanization?
No, I was recently in Tasmania, where I argued that Tasmania is a perfect test bed for these things, because demographically speaking, Tasmania is much ahead of the rest of Australia. So it's a very old state. It has heaps of local government areas, considering how small it is. So you could always run pilots there. But we're not seeing what I'm envisioning at scale yet. I'm envisioning just somebody saying, hey, we are going to be the most innovative small town in delivering regional or remote aged care services, meaning ambulant aged care, where you stay in your home and we have some sort of mobile provider look after you in some sort of way or form. This happens in the Netherlands. That's an existing project there, and we could replicate this in X town. So I think that's the kind of stuff that I would want the regions to do, and that is also a way to get public or federal money, which is what local communities are always after. And so I want that. But what you need there is you need a whole council that is deeply, deeply behind this. And so the council must speak with one voice. They must also have something like the local chamber of commerce or whatever it is on board. And then these things can happen. My main criticism is that this is not happening at scale at the moment. It is that I can't point to, the 15 best projects from the top of my head.
Simon Kustamaha is here. Simon's co-founder of the Demographics Group. Now, I wanted to just, if this is all right, Simon, touch on something else from that report that the UN did, because I noticed some headlines this week saying that Jakarta is now considered the world's most populated city and it has overtaken Tokyo. Now, is that just about population size, or have some of the definitions and some of the boundaries about what makes a city and how many people are in a city, has that changed too?
So it is famously difficult to compare cities across countries, because what is a city? Where do you draw the boundary? What is Melbourne? Melbourne, in one way, is what we consider Greater Melbourne, but that includes areas like Bacchus Marsh, it includes Melton, so areas that are relatively far away and where there's a lot of green space between. But so what the UN does is they measure cities essentially based on continuous urban mass. So they go, you measure this with satellite imagery, and you go, this is one continuous blob of city. And in that measure, Jakarta is now bigger, more populous than even Tokyo, which is ginormous to begin with. But then, of course, if you look at a city that is much bigger in size than the Australian population, you go, well, there are, of course, so many sub-areas in the city. This is not really one functioning city. It is just one continuous urban mass, and somebody who lives on the western side of that city would never, ever go to the eastern side, much like in an Australian city already, by the way.
Yes, absolutely. I certainly know, living in Sydney, that the bridge is considered a very serious dividing line between many of us. Yeah. It is always good to talk, Simon. Thank you so much for being here on Nightlife once again.
Absolute pleasure.
I think this is probably might be your last turn for the year. So thank you for all of your contributions through the year too.
Anytime.
You've been listening to a Nightlife podcast. For more great conversations about the issues that impact you, as well as features on travel and food, head to the Nightlife webpage. You'll find it at abc.net.au/nightlife. You don't need to be a night owl to enjoy the nightlife.